Good morning. This is Brian Trumbore with your Week in Review for Saturday, April 16th. I apologize. This is a little late. I was doing an Easter egg hunt this morning because it's all about the children. So last Friday, April 8th, at 11 p.m. Eastern Time, Congress and the White House reached agreement on a six-month stopgap budget for the remainder of fiscal 2011. It was a week that saw the introduction of Wisconsin Republican Congressman Paul Ryan's deficit reduction plan. Unfortunately, I was finishing up this column that night when the news hit on an end to the impasse, but I had zero details. Nor, as we learned, did anyone in Congress have any 2 days later as leadership made the rounds of the Sunday morning talk shows. Couple this with my motto of wait 24 hours, and it was fruitless of me to comment much last time on the historic debate that has taken place this month and which will carry forward until at least June and probably well beyond. So I need to review the last 2 weeks and fill in some gaps for the record as we've all learned a few details, at least from the Republican side. But first, you had to love the chutzpah of President Obama doing a victory lap on Saturday, April 9, as a result of a government shutdown being averted. He went to the Lincoln Memorial. "Hi, everybody," the president told stunned tourists. "I just wanted to say real quick that because Congress was able to settle its differences, that's why this place is open today and everybody's able to enjoy their visit." Ugh, there was more. "And that's the kind of future cooperation I hope we have going forward, because this is what America is all about. Everybody from different places enjoying those things that bind us together. It is wonderful to spend time with you guys. I hope you have a great time." Well, that was President Obama at the Lincoln Memorial. Good Lord, spare me, spare us all. In fact, we would later learn of that supposed $38 billion reduction in federal spending for the remainder of fiscal 2011 that it actually saved only $352 million, according to the Congressional Budget Office. Some say it doesn't even save that much. In fact, when you figure in emergency spending on Iraq and Afghanistan, it actually spends $3 billion more. It seems that a large portion of the $38 billion was a result of money that was unlikely to be spent in any case. It was all just total BS. Nonetheless, this past Thursday, the House voted 260 to 167 for the measure. The Senate followed, voting 81-19 in favor of the budget deal, and the government and the troops are funded through September. Editorial, Wall Street Journal. But the continuing resolution also saves money on paper through phantom cuts. The Whopper is declaring $6.2 billion in savings by not spending money left from the 2010 census. Congress also cuts $4.9 billion from the Justice Department's Crime Victims Fund, but much of that money was tucked away in a reserve fund that wouldn't have been spent this year in any event. This is infuriating given the GOP leadership's flogging of that $38 billion top-line figure. But this was a week that also saw the Republican House proceed to act immediately on Congressman Ryan's deficit reduction plan for 2012 and beyond, a gutty move to put the White House back on the defensive after the president's speech on Wednesday. Republicans passed the budget blueprint on a virtual party line vote, 235 to 193, with no Democrats voting for it and four Republicans voting against. But while there is no chance of passage in the Democratic-controlled Senate, Republicans regain the policy advantage for the coming fight. So, since I didn't go into any detail last time, let's look at the Ryan effort. Some quotes from Mr. Ryan. "Our budget, which we call the Path of Prosperity, cuts $6.2 trillion. I just note that the new number being talked about is $5.8 trillion. In spending from the president's budget of the next 10 years, reduces the debt as a percentage of the economy and puts the nation on a path to actually pay off our national debt. Our proposal brings federal spending to below 20% of gross domestic product, consistent with the post-war average, and reduces deficits by $4.4 trillion. This is America's moment to advance a plan for prosperity. We can reform government so that people don't have to reorient their lives for less. We can grow our economy, promote opportunity, and encourage upward mobility. This budget is the new House majority's answer to history's call. It is now up to all of us to keep America exceptional. I apologize. That's the weather bug on the computer. We have some severe weather coming in. That's funny. Ryan's proposal calls for a bipartisan. Actually, that really was a metaphor for the fiscal crisis, wasn't it? Ryan's proposal calls for a bipartisan solution on Social Security, which is indeed very doable and, frankly, simple. But for Medicaid, the central government health care plan for low-income individuals, Ryan endorses spending in the form of block grants given to states based on population. The states then could develop their own plan for distributing the funds rather than having to follow federal rules. There needs to be a safety net for people who cannot help themselves. There needs to be a safety net for people who are down on their luck, Ryan says, but we don't want to turn that safety net into a hammock that lulls people to lives of complacency and dependency. Our safety net is tearing apart at the seams. Editorial, Wall Street Journal. Mr. Ryan's budget rollout is an important political and policy moment because it is the most serious attempt to reform government in at least a generation. The plan offers what voters have been saying they want, a blueprint to address the roots of Washington's fiscal disorder. It does so not by the usual posturing, paygo, and symbolism, balanced budget amendment, but by going to the heart of the spending problem, especially on the vast and rapidly growing health care entitlements of Medicaid and Medicare. Senator Tom Coburn, Republican, Oklahoma, from the New York Post. If Congress is serious about preserving economic prosperity and freedoms for the next generation, we must change course. Purveyors of conventional wisdom have long argued that structural reforms to Medicare and Medicaid are too risky politically. Yet the greater risk is to toss away our country's future by continuing down our present path. The time to start the conversation about reforming these entitlements is now. Christopher Caldwell, Financial Times. The story of the past half century is that Americans found a way to extract money from future generations and leave them with the bill. What they have been enjoying is not prosperity, but luxury. As Mr. Ryan sees, they face the serious and open question of whether they are morally capable over the long term of living within their means. On Wednesday, President Obama announced his proposal. He called for a mix of spending reductions and tax hikes that the White House claims would cut federal deficits by $4 trillion over the next 12 years without gutting Medicare and Medicaid. Of the Ryan plan, Obama said, quote, "These are the kind of cuts that tell us we can't afford the America that I believe in and that I think you believe in. I believe it paints a vision of our future that's deeply pessimistic." On Republican plans to cut taxes on the wealthy while making the elderly pay more for their health care, Obama said, "This is not a vision of the America I know. They want to give people like me a $200,000 tax cut that's paid for by asking seniors to each pay $6,000 more in health cost. That's not right, and it's not going to happen as long as I'm president. The fact is their vision is less about reducing the deficit than it is about changing the basic social compact in America. There's nothing serious about a plan that claims to reduce the deficit by spending $1 trillion on tax cuts for millionaires and billionaires." Well, instead, the president offered, quote, "We have to live within our means, reduce our deficit, and get back on a path that will allow us to pay down our debt. And we have to do it in a way that protects the recovery and protects the investments we need to grow, create jobs, and win the future." God, I hate that term, win the future. Republican Congressman Jeb Hensarling of Texas. At a time when millions of our countrymen remain unemployed, the president again proposes tax increases on job creators, calling Obama's speech class warfare. Congressman Paul Ryan, "Exploiting people's emotions of fear, envy, and anxiety is not hope, it's not change, it's partisanship. We don't need partisanship. We don't need demagoguery. We need solutions." House Speaker John Boehner, Republican, Ohio. "Any plan that starts with job-destroying tax hikes is a non-starter. Republicans are fighting for meaningful spending cuts and fighting against any tax increase on American small businesses." Editorial, Wall Street Journal. Did someone move the election to June 1st? We ask because President Obama's extraordinary response to Paul Ryan's budget yesterday, with its blistering bipartisanship and multiple distortions, was the kind presidents usually outsource to some junior lieutenant. Mr. Obama's fundamentally political document would have been unusual even for a vice president in the fervor of a campaign. The journal continues, the immediate political goal was to inoculate the White House from criticism that it is not serious about the fiscal crisis after ignoring its own deficit commission last year and tossing off a $3.73 trillion budget in February that increased spending amid a record deficit of $1.65 trillion. Mr. Obama was chased by George Washington University yesterday because Mr. Ryan and the Republicans outflanked him on fiscal discipline and are now setting the national political agenda. Mr. Obama did not deign to propose an alternative to rival Mr. Ryan's plan, even as he categorically rejected all its reform ideas, repeatedly vilifying them as essentially un-American. The president was not attempting to join the debate Mr. Ryan has started, but to close it off just as it begins and banish House GOP ideas to political Siberia. Mr. Obama then packaged his poison in the rhetoric of bipartisanship, which starts, he said, by being honest about what's causing our deficit. The speech he chose to deliver was dishonest even by modern political standards. Mr. Obama ludicrously claimed that Mr. Ryan favors a fundamentally different America than one we've known throughout most of our history. Nothing is likelier to bring that future about than the president's political indifference in the midst of a fiscal crisis. Turning to Europe, the situation in Greece, see the future U.S., has gone from bad to worse, with the bond market voicing its displeasure that the country seems too far gone to avoid default. A board member at the European Central Bank, Lorenzo Binismahi, said the Greek debt restructuring would be a, quote, catastrophe, and that it would result in the bankruptcy of a large part of the country's banking system. The Greek economy would be on its knees, he said, with devastating effects on social cohesion and the maintenance of democracy in that country. It's up to Greece to decide the way forward, given that it will suffer the worst consequences. Other countries must avoid pushing it towards a catastrophe. Greece, which had unemployment of 9% in mid-2009, is now headed to 15.5% this year. GDP is going to fall another 3% plus at this point. But it's the ECB, the IMF, and Germany, which is really an independent third player in this whole crisis, that are pushing Greece as well as Ireland and Portugal over the cliff. Sorry to beat a dead horse, but the entire Euro 17, particularly these three, need growth, and it's tough to have growth when you are continuing to slash jobs and entitlements. Yes, both are warranted, but this is the box many members of the EU find themselves in, as does America. It's a formula that is not about to work, but Mr. Smy hit on one of my main points for the past year when looking at Europe's debt crisis. You ain't seen nothing yet when it comes to domestic turmoil, and for some to say, well, who gives a rat's ass about Greece? They don't know their history. It can spread. Greece is in the Balkans, after all. Meanwhile, Portugal has applied for an ECB bailout, but its government is in chaos until the June 5th election, and there's no telling what the new government will do in terms of required austerity, seeing as the old government, just booted out, couldn't get its plan through, which led to the collapse of the socialist. The ECB is demanding Portugal come up with a plan before it loans the nation, in conjunction with the IMF, somewhere in the neighborhood of $115 to $125 billion, and that the plan must be in place long before the election. As for Ireland, it was downgraded another few notches by Moody's, while Spain, which continues to say it will never need ECB assistance, had to admit that China had not, contrary to reports, invested $14 billion in its troubled savings banks. The IMF called on all European banks to boost their capital levels, as I've said was a key issue all along, as some German banks are, quote, vulnerable to further shocks. Yep, already know this. George Soros said that Europe's refusal to allow members of the Euro 17 to restructure their debt has added to moral hazard in the financial system. quote, look at the situation in Europe where authorities are insisting on no renegotiation or restructuring on outstanding debt because that could possibly provide a financial banking crisis. At the present, we bail out, but in the future, we will bail in. It has absolutely no credibility. Lastly, on another of my favorite topics, immigration in Europe, the New York Times had this headline on April 12. Fears about immigrants deepen divisions in Europe. It's a massive issue, and I'll have far more when I report to you from Paris in a few weeks, though that won't be in the form of a podcast. Turning to Wall Street, stocks registered fractional losses in a second straight dull week, with the Dow Jones off 0.3% to 12,341, while the S&P 500 lost 0.5% and NASDAQ declined 0.6%. The IPO market supplied a little juice with two hot offerings, Zipcar and the world's largest McDonald's franchisee, Arcos Dorados Holdings of Latin America. But the few big players releasing first quarter earnings were nothing to write home about and offered little cause for optimism. We'll get a fuller picture this coming week with far more releases. That's all for this week. I'll be back with you next Saturday. Have a good one. For further details, especially on the foreign affairs side, go to stocksandnews.com and click on Week in Review. Take care.